If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.
This episode of the Partially Examined Life is brought to you by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price, because everyone deserves a great night's sleep. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/PEL and enter promo code PEL.
Tonight's live podcast will be an examination of the philosophy of Hannah Arendt with a particular focus on the question of public philosophy. Please join me in welcoming Mark, Wes, Seth, and Dylan, the Partially Examined Life, to our conference.
You're listening to the Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys.
He already said that. I don't have to say this. I will say thank you to Justin Pearl for organizing this, inviting us to come down here to Pittsburgh. Woo! Yeah, there is an audience. We are live. This recording will become our episode 125. How many people are caught up? Did y'all listen to the previous 124 to get ready for this?
Yes.
At least two people.
I haven't even listened to all 124.
The ones that you missed, you're just like, well, I missed it, so I don't have to take that part of my life up with that by listening back to it and imagining what it would be like if I were there. So we're going to try our best here to, well, first of all, I know we were going to do a show of hands. How many people have never heard the podcast, don't know anything about this? Okay, so we have some honest judges here. We're not experts. We just read this book this week, the last couple weeks. In fact, we just read the first part of the book, so... For instance, Entitled Opinions, another good podcast. They have a couple episodes where they talk about the whole book. We don't do that. We would like to dive into the text. So we read of Hannah Arendt's The Human Condition from 1958. We read the first 78 pages. So that's the prologue. That's section one, The Human Condition. That's two, The Public and the Private Realm, which, of course, is sort of like at least what the theme of this conference is supposed to be. I don't know if she talks about philosophy in the public space exactly, because this is all about the vita activa, the active life, not the vita complentiva.
Contemplativa.
Complentativa is specifically excluded from this, but it's at least there. It's there as a negative. So who wants to start? Just give your initial impressions of this.
So Hannah Arendt, I guess, is best known in the popular imagination for Eichmann in Jerusalem, A Study in the Banality of Evil. She also has a very famous two volumes of a potential three-volume set called The Life of the Mind. The Human Condition was a very popular book in its day, as I understand it, but it's not something that shows up on curriculum typically these days in philosophy departments. So it was a real pleasure to discover this because it's a fascinating work that's rich. Every page is loaded with ideas. And this particular edition, which I guess is the authoritative edition, the introduction by Margaret Canavan is very good. And she explains how this book was initially met with a certain amount of confusion because it's not argumentative in a traditional philosophical sense. She's not stating a thesis and then arguing for it and giving support in the traditional sense. It's not a genealogy.
Well, I think it is kind of a...
You think so?
I disagree with both of the things you just said.
Okay. Well, then please feel free to disagree. She's making a lot of claims without necessarily providing a rigorous or what we would typically consider an ordered or structured argument up to those claims. But that doesn't mean that they're not supported. She has a tremendous amount of textual and historical support for what she's saying, but she's speaking very declaratively in my reading of it.
I was just thinking it was a genealogy in the sense that in her prologue, she states her purpose, which is to trace the origins of contemporary alienation to what she calls the modern age, which is basically the 17th century on. What she's thinking of as contemporary is the post-atomic age, or what she calls the modern world. And in doing that, she's going to give the genealogy of that alienation in terms of this old distinction between public and private, between the political, in a different sense, mm-hmm. that's collapsed. The argument is that that's the source of our alienation. That's what I took to be the thesis. Your overall point, I agree with. It's not I mean, much of the evidence is sort of elusive or etymological. You know, the idea, for instance, that the law was primarily a barrier meant to keep public and private separate, which she gets from Heraclitus, a fragment of Heraclitus. And that's the only evidence you get in the text. So it's that kind of, I think you're alluding to that kind of...
I'm alluding to the fact that much of the evidentiary work gets done in footnotes, which is not to say it's not convincing. That's just a choice stylistically that's interesting.
Dylan, give us your opening thoughts, if you please. I just feel bad. Mark, now you're a physical presence.
Mark is
facing the space here, and now I...
Mark, are you the head of the household, or is this a community of peers?
Is this a polis, Mark? Are we all free?
I think violence is justified and establish them initial order. See, we're already making inside jokes about the book. We have to talk about the book first.
So the phrase that came to my mind when we were you're just mentioning about like the... I guess I didn't find it all that peculiar, but as an academic book, it feels a bit peculiar. And the way she talks about it in the prologue is she says, what I propose, therefore, is very simple. It's nothing more than think about what we were doing.
It's to think
what
we
are doing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Think what we are.
Yeah, think what we're doing. I wanted to put an about in there, maybe.
That's the social creeping in on you.
Yeah, maybe it is. So it made an impression on me that this book is essentially one part of a thinking about human living, this being the human condition. The way she starts off on it is, and maybe we can get started on the first chapter, I guess, about the notion of being conditioned at all. She wants to, that I guess that's where the genealogy part came in for me, is thinking about what factors condition us as human beings and how those conditions have changed and how that's changed us. And she clearly has an argument in that she thinks that some of the ways we've been conditioned by modernity are in some sense negative for our humanity.
So just a quick overview of the three sections that we went through, of which is about the first third of the book or so. The prologue that you were talking about, why is this called the human condition as opposed to human nature? What's wrong with human nature?
Yep.
So saying something about the difference between that. The second one, which is quite a bit longer, so part one, is on the vita activa, right, the active life. And she thinks that the philosophy from Plato has always favored the other one, the contemplative life. In making that distinction, in favoring the contemplative life, we've shoved together all of the active parts. So she gives these three divisions that we'll talk about. In fact, there are whole chapters on each of them that we kind of maybe skimmed if we read past what we agreed to read. Labor, work, and action.
They're all part of vita activa.
Yeah, those kind of sound like the same thing. But labor is kind of repetitive. The thing you have to do to stay alive, it's attached to your biology, whereas work actually creates works. It is supposedly creating something. It's not just to keep yourself alive from day to day, but creates lasting things. It creates the public world that we then share, that then feeds into the human condition. Action, which is the one she's most excited about, it seems to be specifically political activity. That it's only when you sort of take care of the living, and she gives ancient Greek polis as her prime example, that to be admitted to the debates within the polis, you had to have a certain property level, not because it was a plutocracy or something, but because it was only people that had the free time to do this, who had slaves and people at home taking care of all the stuff that would feed them.
Who had the freedom to do that.
Yes, then that's what gives you the freedom to then enter this community of peers, the polis, and engage in political activity, which involves mostly trying to convince each other of stuff.
Let me just put a little bit of color onto the three sections, labor, work, and action. Labor, you can think of as central to the idea of survival. Mm-hmm. Labor is everything that we do to survive. So it's procreation, it's eating, it's that sort of thing. Work.
So it's both biological processes and it's things that we do to support ourselves.
Yes.
So I think that's
labor in the sense of manual labor.
And right? So it's also anything that you would think of as tending or repetitive.
Sure.
It's non-productive. So
wait,
the
am I? It can be productive in the sense that I think there's labor in the household that doesn't necessarily produce works. She associates the idea of work as creating what she calls artificial things as opposed to things in the natural world and as opposed to the products of pure labor.
Which are consumed.
Well, and works imply permanence. So labor is for survival, works are for permanence, and action, she says, is what generates history. Action is the interaction or activity between people without an intermediary of a thing or matter. So literally human interaction.
Speech,
well, we'll get to that. That's why I think it has a broader connotation than just politics.
It's words and deeds, so then the two are very closely connected.
Yeah.
So that's part one, where she gets done at least introducing those three terms. Our third part, part two in the book, is called The Public and the Private Realm, which is when she takes this distinction between work and labor, which already you can see sounds a little tenuous. Does it, what do you mean only the products of labor get consumed? What counts as a consumable? Well, different societies are going to have different attitudes toward that. And so our third section, The Public and the Private Realm, gets a little more into her critique. And a lot of it is this historical progression of how the private realm, how the public realm, and in turn how labor and work and the role of the politics and all this, how those have evolved over time. And a lot of it has to do with lionizing the ancient Greek polis, but there are some things, even like the private realm was pretty crappy in ancient Greece in that it was a guy bossing his wife and his kids and his slaves around. So yes, Arendt thinks there have been advances since then in the richness of the private realm, but there was something about the public realm that's been lost.
Not the richness of the private realm, the richness of what we call the intimate.
The richness is predicated on the discovery of the intimate.
Feelings and emotions are heightened, and that we have artistic activities like the novel that focus on doing that. But I think she thinks the private realm is impoverished. I mean, in a sense, that the whole point of this section is that there is no public-private distinction. In what we call the social, housekeeping matters, the matters of necessity, the things we do to survive, have been elevated to the level of the political. So they've become a common interest. So, for instance, that's what concern with economics is. The question is how to manage the society household, and those primarily become political matters, as opposed to whatever it is they did in the polis, which is not entirely.
In a funny way, the private has overcome the public, and the public has overcome the private. I mean, both those things have happened in the victory of the social, and both have suffered, and part of her argument is that that's been to the detriment of our human action, because for her, what constitutes our humanness is our ability to act politically.
This is the point where I insist that we start building the argument from the beginning.
So start reading.
But I want to give one more sentence in terms of what this social is.
One.
Social is the boogeyman of the story.
Yes, agreed.
The difference between the political and the social, as we're saying, if the political is like the polis, where it's equals gathering together, the social is like Heidegger's the they, or the thing that Kierkegaard was complaining about.
It's utterly leveling.
Yes, it is conformist, and when you do economic analysis, that's sort of the highfalutin, you know, you're doing a statistical analysis of masses of people. Mass society is really what is being critiqued here, that in the polis, when you were being political, you were getting in there and exerting your individuality. You were trying to do great works and great deeds by, again, we're not really sure what you're really supposed to be shooting for, but it's not what is happening now in politics, which is the classes representing their economic interests and crap like that.
Yeah, she clearly sees the seeds of existential angst and the seeds of totalitarianism in the same place as the victory of the social. She sees those as conditions of modernity that have the same roots in them. And for her, it's no surprise that you have both of those things happening at the same time.
Yep.
All right, so let's go to the beginning. People are going to have a lot of questions. We are going to have a part at the end where we will pass the mic around and take some questions or take your comments. So who's familiar with this book? Who's read this book? All right, so many more people are more knowledgeable in the audience than we are about this. And also, people that are being broadcast to via the little tiny mic over there, they are welcome to post on the YouTube channel. And our friend Aaron over here will, at some point during that, look over those and see if any of them are worthy to enter this public space as opposed to the internet non-space social. I don't know what that is.
That sounds violent.
It's very leveling, that YouTube.
Okay.
So where did you want to...
We start on the prologue?
Did you want to take us?
No, I want to start in section one. We should probably say something at some point a little bit more about how human condition and human nature are not the same thing and why she's not a fan of human nature. So I just want to put that on the table for now, but make sure that we keep it in our mind.
Yeah, that's the end of the section one.
Yep. Right. So she says that Vita Activa has its tradition in political thought from the trial of Socrates all the way through Marx. And she says it's originally defined as a life devoted to public political matters. And what she means by that, she's using as a model, she says generally the ancient Greek city-state, but I think we probably all know she probably has one in particular in mind, I imagine.
Sparta.
No, not Sparta. So the structure that exists in the ancient Greek city-state, according to Hannah Arendt, is you have a private realm and a public realm. The private realm is the household, and the household is constituted by property, not just in the sense of a physical space, although that's important, but the idea that it's productive in the way that it can support the citizen who owns the property. So it's truly private, and it's pre-political in the sense that there's no law. In other words, the person who is the head of the household is a tyrant in their own household. They have complete and total authority over all members of the household, and there is no intrusion into the household by public law to tell them what they can and cannot do.
This is her response to social contract theory, that it's not that we get together and form a state as the first organization. It's that the family unit is first, which is really sort of following Hegel, one person coming, clubbing another on the head, and now you're in my household, my servant, whatever.
My slave.
And it's funny that Arendt actually says that they're justified in doing that. Obviously, she doesn't mean this in sort of Kantian moral sense, but that the necessities of staying alive justify the use of violence in this way.
Well, she says they thought it justified that. I mean, she doesn't. I know this.
I thought she was just twisting the word.
The general tone of this book, yes. You wonder about how she feels about slavery and all these things, but she doesn't give you her opinion about that.
I mean, this is later on in the book where she says, what all Greek philosophers took for granted is that freedom is exclusively located in the political realm, that necessity is primarily a pre-political phenomenon. Because all human beings are subject to necessity, they are entitled to violence towards others. Violence is the pre-political act of liberating oneself from the necessity of life for the freedom of the world. And so then the polis is the political response to that. So you are active, you are free in the polis without violence.
Yeah.
That's the big difference.
That's a huge difference. But let me go on a mini extended riff. There's a big chunk in here where she talks about Aristotelian and Platonic views on slavery and this idea that slaves were not strong enough to become free, that they deserve where they're at because they didn't exercise the violence enough to make themselves free in this sense. And that's why the notion of this violent overthrow, the freedom that you get by controlling your necessity, you win through violence. And the household is constituted by violence. And that's really important because the polis, in her construction of the ancient Greek state, there's no violence in the public realm amongst the equals, precisely because they are equals.
So that's section 5 we just discussed.
Did we? All right.
That's chapter, that's page 30. Yeah, I read from page 31. I don't know how you thought you were starting at the beginning.
I am starting at the beginning.
You're not at the beginning.
Well, this is my summary of this. I'm pulling this together. I got a thread here.
Wow.
I got lots of notes. All right. So.
Hey, well, Wes, show them your crazy ass book with your. Every page completely covered with your own writing.
Yeah, first I do this, and then I write my summary. I rewrite it in my much less eloquent terms.
So, all right, so you have the household.
Show them your
This is my notebook.
Everybody has notebooks like that.
Yeah. Okay, so the
do you
polis.
Do you have graphing on that? Is that it have y-axes?
it is graph paper. I couldn't find a blank page.
It doubles for when we read Descartes.
Okay. When I talk to Marilyn about proto-Pythagoreans. Okay, so you have this picture of the household constituted by violence, totally private. So then you have the public space, the polis, which is where these free individuals who've been freed from necessity come together. And that is the political realm. And in this realm, there is law, because it's a realm amongst equals, and it's ruled by rhetoric and persuasion as opposed to violence. This is very important to keep in mind for later on. And this, for her, is the original sphere of action in the sense that we talked about the vita activa, where you said labor, work, and action. This is the original sphere when action was speech and deeds in this purely political space as defined in the Greek sense.
The basic idea is that the way we think of the active life, we think of what we got from Plato, which is that there's the, and Aristotle, that there's the contemplative life, and then there's the active life. And the active life lumps together everything that's not contemplative. Well, actually, no, I think Plato and Aristotle, it's more complicated. I think she attributes the rise of that to Augustine. But the idea is that the dividing line at some point fell between public life or political life and those other activities. And that sets us up for this transition in Chapter 2, where the dividing line gets shifted and what we're traditionally thought of as distinct, the public and the private or the political and the household get squished together. And now there's a new dividing line between that and what she calls the intimate.
So in that old system where you've got the public and then the private, which is devoted to the economic, so where does philosophy fall? Or is it just not significant enough to fall in either of those?
Philosophy is a response. to that division. It doesn't fit in that division initially. It's a response to that. That's how I understood it.
Unless you were to understand philosophy as only being the contemplation of truth, and that then it would fit in the contempliva part. If that's what you understood philosophy to be, is only that.
Right. It sounds like it's a later, there's some dialectic going on. It's something that comes out of the connection between them, because it is neither of those things. You don't have Socrates going up in the Athenian assembly and saying, "My fellow gentlemen, what is truth?" And expecting to have the kind of dialogue that he had. Because it's among equals and not Socrates and his little whipping boys, it wouldn't have quite the same dynamic.
It wasn't Socrates' whipping boy. It was Minos' whipping boy. Socrates was talking to him.
Socrates and his whipping boys.
No, it wasn't.
Minos, all right.
So
literal and figurative whipping boys. All of them... Whipping.
All right, before we return to our heroes in Pittsburgh and talk more about the human condition, let's hear about our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the cost. Now, you might think that going to a mattress shop, trying out the mattresses, lying on them, that's part of the process. But really, statistically, lying in a bed in a showroom has no correlation to whether it's the right bed for you. So that big, nice showroom with all the mattresses, all the people showing you things, that's just part of what you're paying for. It's an enormous waste. Now, Casper is able to offer mattresses much more cheaply because they don't do that. You order it online. Now, Casper understands the importance of really trying out a mattress, which is why they offer a 100-day period in which you can painlessly return it. Plus, you get free delivery in the first place. Casper's mattresses are way below the cost of what you're going to see in a showroom. You can get $500 for a twin or $950 for a king-size mattress. Compared to industry averages, that's an outstanding price point. And you can save an additional $50 as one of our audience members by going to casper.com/PEL and entering the promo code PEL. Now, I have one of these mattresses. I've been using it for months now. I have absolutely no complaints. It's very comfortable. It combines latex and memory foam, long-lasting comfort and support. So go ahead, try sleeping on a Casper mattress. You can buy it easily online, completely risk-free. Casper's mattresses are made in the USA. Remember, that's casper.com/PEL. Enter the promo code PEL. All right, sorry for the interruption. Just to remind you, if you go to partiallyexaminedlife.com and become a Partially Examined Life citizen for a mere $5 a month or $50 for the year, then not only will you not be interrupted by these commercials ever again, but you'll get the second hour of this discussion right now, a week in advance of everybody else. All right, and now back to Pittsburgh.
One thing about the beginning is she just lays out what she's thinking about in terms of the human condition.
Yeah.
Right? So articulating labor, work, and action, and then this whole idea of being conditioned.
And the idea is that everything we come into contact with conditions us.
And that conditions us, and then we also, as human beings, are capable of creating things that condition us.
Yeah, everything we create. So the thing is, she says that in the beginning, but it doesn't really start to make sense until you get a little bit later on. Maybe that's why I reordered to make the narrative better for our audience.
So you're rewriting your book for her?
While we're on that.
You're rewriting your book for
her. Let's get the distinction between the human condition and human nature that she makes in this.
I think that's a good place to start.
Well, the distinction is basically the conditions of human existence can never really explain who we are because they can never condition us absolutely. So what's a better way to put this? There's no human nature for her in the sense that, and this is related to her talk of political action as an expression of individuality, as opposed to this idea that human beings can be the objects of science and that their behavior can be predicted, that there's a certain kind of uniformity. That assumes a certain kind of uniform human nature. But whatever our conditions, they never absolutely determine us in that way. So, for instance, I think she gives the example of human beings going off into space and being entirely conditioned only by what is artificial, having no natural element.
Escaping the world.
To that. Yeah. So human conditions can actually change radically without changing the,
presumably changing human nature. It's just that we couldn't even know what this human nature is unless we were God, she said.
Yeah. She says, first of all, the human condition she's looking at is not human nature. And the first sign of that is that there's this whole realm, the contemplative life, which she has a whole other two books on, that is not considered here. And that would be part of any kind of full consideration. So that's one thing. And then she's also doubtful that human nature even exists. She's doubtful herself. And if it does exist, she says, if we have a nature or an essence, this is a bottom of 10, then surely only a God could know and define it, and the prerequisite would be that he be able to speak about who as though it were a what.
Right. So there's something about subjectivity that defies attributing an essence, basically.
Yes.
Well, and somewhere later she says that it's only because of this horrible situation where we've lost track of what the political realm and so true freedom is that we don't have the free will determinism question posed in philosophy the way it is. That we've lost track of what it really is to be compelled like a slave as opposed to being free like a politician in the polis. That doesn't seem to do justice to the episode on free will, say, that we did. But let's give that to her. Also in the prologue here, Wes mentioned this going into space, and this is actually what she starts with, that how what
Sputnik.
A monumental importance, yes, Sputnik, the 1957 space launch, that this was our first step toward escape from man's imprisonment to the Earth, that this is something that we've always wanted to do. And the other thing she brings up, one of my favorite social issues, is automation, how we were saying labor seems like a primary thing of the human condition. Well, if you make enough machines so that people don't have to labor as much or much at all, so we're all more or less free in the sense that these Athenian politicians were, then what does that do to the human condition? It seems that we're entering a whole new realm. One of the points she makes there to say why she's writing this book, why she wants to promote a more thoughtful approach to life, a more free approach to life, is because she thinks part of this incursion of society onto every single realm of human experience has resulted in us becoming a laboring animal. She has another Latin term for it.
Animal laborans.
Animal laborans. That we define ourselves in terms of our jobs. Basically, if we get this freedom, we don't know what to do with it. And that's very clear in economic discussions now. When you read articles, there was one in The Atlantic recently about automation's finally coming down the pipe. Of course, this is 1958. She thought it was going to happen within the next 10 years from then. It always seems to get pushed down the road. But eventually, we'll get enough so we'll run out of full-time jobs or whatever and have to think of something else to do with it. But we are in such a state, obviously, according to all our political rhetoric, where the thought of actually making it a goal for people to work 10 hours a week or 5 hours a week or whatever, which might be necessitated by this, either that or 90% unemployment, is just something that's not even on the table. So that's the kind of thing she wants us to reconsider. The other part of that is this attempt to escape from, that sounds like maybe a good way that we could escape from one of the human conditions. It's something that mankind has always wanted to be free from laboring. And so maybe we should just kind of remember that and adjust ourselves appropriately. But another thing people use this book for is to criticize things like transhumanism or genetic engineering, ways that we can write into nature, that we can take these acts. And she talks specifically about the physics of her time that was, you know, quantum mechanics that was getting so that nobody could even understand it anymore. You couldn't even explain it. And she says,
you couldn't speak it.
Right, right.
Well, that's
well
really
understand,
important.
We will forever be able to understand, to think and speak about things which nevertheless we are able to do.
Yes.
Page 3.
Well, it's...
Yeah, but
so we're in danger.
Let me read that whole. But it could be that this is page 3. She's worried about the loss of the ability to think. That's why Dylan's mention of this idea that she wants to think what we are doing. Mm-hmm. So her worry is that we're going to lose the ability to talk about what we do. And again, this brings us to this important unity between speech and action. But it could be that we, who are earthbound creatures and have begun to act as though we are dwellers of the universe, will forever be unable to understand, that is, to think and speak about the things which nevertheless we are able to do. So
yes.
Technology gives us the leverage to do all of these new things, but it also interferes with our ability to talk about them, especially if we cede that ground simply to scientists, because talking about these things, even if they're scientific in nature, is not itself a scientific activity.
Yeah, so at the end of that paragraph, if it should turn out to be true that knowledge in the modern sense of know-how and thought have parted company for good, then we would indeed become the helpless slaves, not so much of our machines as of our know-how, thoughtless creatures at the mercy of every gadget, which is technically possible, no matter how murderous it is. You start smelling Heidegger a little bit there.
Boy, man, if she had known about the iPhone.
Yeah. About the scientist stuff, she says on the next page, the reason why it may be wise to distrust the political judgment of scientists qua scientists is not primarily the lack of character, that is like they're, you know, evil or something like that, but that they did not refuse to develop atomic weapons, or their naivete, that they did not understand that once these weapons were developed, they would be the last to be consulted about their use, but precisely the fact that they move in a world where speech has lost its power. And whatever men do or know or experience can make sense only to the extent that it can be spoken about. There may be truths beyond speech, and they may be of great relevance to man in the singular, that is, to man insofar as he is not a political being, whatever else he may be. Men in the plural, that is, men insofar as they live and move and act in this world, can experience meaningfulness only because they can walk with and make sense to each other and to themselves. Talk with, right, not just walk. Talk with and make sense to each other and themselves. And so this is why being unable to speak science for her is, it's not that you can't write down an equation, it's not that you can't explain it, but that the speaking of what you're doing, you're not able to completely articulate. And I guess she doesn't talk about it this way, but she must have in mind the interpretive problems in quantum mechanics.
I'm pretty sure she did.
You could predict an experiment and write down an equation and have it, in fact, be the most successful theory ever, in the sense that I can do a measurement out to 7 digits or 8 digits or 10 digits. I can tell you what's a measurement of in the sense of these lines, but I can't tell you what a wave function is.
Yeah, the reason why I also thought of quantum mechanics, just because she says that this language of mathematical symbols was originally meant only as an abbreviation for spoken statements, but we've gotten to the point where
they're not.
You can no longer translate. There are mathematical statements which you really can't translate.
Well, in fact, that would be the power of it, right?
Yeah.
Is that early on, they are just a transliteration of language, but the development of the symbolism that has its own internal meaning and grammar.
I would also point out that this is important only to the extent that the scientific things that we're unable to put into words and to speak to each other impact our lives in a political or what we'll come to talk about as a social sense. If it was just a way of impacting works that didn't condition us, although they all do, then it wouldn't be as big a deal. The fact is, she's mentioning specifically, she's thinking atomic power, she's thinking nuclear bomb, you know, she's thinking about things where those who play a role in policy and society, and that we...
It's more fundamental, It's the idea that it deprives us of the ability to be actors, to act, because if we can't speak what we're doing, we're no longer in the realm of action.
I understand. I see why she thinks this is particularly true in quantum mechanics, or that she would be influenced by that. But why is it any different than with any other kind of technology in terms of conditioning us, in terms of having know-how that we can't explain? It seems like the history of technology is riddled with that kind of thing. We could build lenses before we knew how lenses work. We could build batteries before we knew how batteries work. We could build guns before we knew how guns work. In fact, most of the things that we built, we don't know how they work. We were able to build them before that.
And then not to hold our feet to the fire on the quantum mechanics thing.
No, what I'm trying to make sense of her claim of this being peculiarly modern and that it's particularly important right now, not simply in the age of nuclear power.
Well, she gives this demarcation
where the modern age
is. It's the post-atomic age that's specifically what she means.
And I guess I'm trying to
the modern world. Sorry.
Her analysis seems to apply more than that, unless I'm missing something.
Well, she's linking what she calls a modern world. It's a little confusing. The modern world, which is the post-atomic age, to the modern age, which is 17th century. That's part of the whole genealogy, to trace that back. I have the same question. Technology has been around for a long time. What specific, because she doesn't explain that.
It's been conditioning us for a long time.
What specifically about the post-atomic age, other than the fact that we can completely destroy ourselves. Maybe it has something to do with this idea of the ability to leave Earth and go into space. This idea that now we can actually, we have the means to
escape
incredible means to try to do that. Because escaping the Earth is just for her, a metaphor for trying to escape the human condition.
Right.
In the sense that the Earth provides what is natural for us and is the realm of necessity.
So it seems what is essential is that the political process, she thinks, is broken. That perhaps, even if we had really complicated science, we had science advisors that would then advise us, and then we would have a public debate on whether we should use biotechnology or whatever, then perhaps we could then proceed. This is what she's recommending, that we proceed with deliberation and, you know, hopefully avoid catastrophe. If everything is the social instead of the political, so there is no formal forum, instead you have competing companies just trying to outdo each other, or different governments around the world, just, you know, somebody, even if we have a sensible discussion here about not going forward in some dangerous technological area, somebody else will go forward. And that's the way that these innovations come about, not from the decisions of a deliberate body, but organically, unconsciously, in an uncontrolled
way. I'm a little more confused about this because of that part that Dylan read, where it's not a matter of the lack of character. It's not that they didn't refuse to develop atomic weapons, or that it seems not to be a policy, a question of did we or did we not have the right policy. It seems like he's trying to get at something more fundamental, although it's not exact, this whole idea of speaking what you do, but...
Well, but isn't it that for her that scientists in what they do are utterly unprepared to be political? They're unprepared for any kind of political activity because they can't speak about what they're doing. And so it requires, in her argument, a different act than what's intrinsic to a scientist to make that articulation.
So,
hence the thinking what we do.
I think she still has in mind this idealized state where all of the actors in the political realm are empowered and equal, mm-hmm. and that they're making decisions which impact. And the threat that rears its head in science kind of does come up in the social, which we have to talk about. But basically, it's much worse when you have a situation where instead of free actors who are engaged with each other politically and making decisions and speaking and persuading, instead we have this great leveling thing called society that dictates behaviors to people, and where technology can run away and start to get this pervasive influence where we're not consciously making decisions amongst ourselves about how to act, but instead we're having behaviors imposed upon us. We're not acting freely.
Yeah. And that seems to be like her biggest concern, right? That the human condition, there are things that condition us, but for her, the greatest flourishing of the human being under human condition is being free. And that there are a variety of threats to that, and some of which she thinks are peculiar to the modern era.
Let's rewind back then and start talking about
we'll go back to the beginning.
Vita activa.
To the social. Let's talk about how the social emerges out of that. Would you like to hear me make a mistake so you can correct me now?
Sorry. I do thrive on that, though.
So she says that the Aristotelian formulation, zoon politikon, which is also reads as zoon logon ekon, should be read as a living being capable of speech. And she says this is mistranslated in Latin or misappropriated as animal rationale, or worse, she says, social animal. Mm-hmm. In fact, she blames Latin and Rome for bringing in the notion of the social, which she says has no equivalent in Greek, that basically the political becomes the social in the Roman lexicon. And part of the reason for that is that Rome is a different kind of political entity to begin with. It's a nation state as opposed to a city state. It's a much broader governmental entity that requires a different kind of administration. And in fact, this idea of the social or social economy means that the nation state treats itself as a collective household. So the transition from Greece to Rome is a transition from the political to the social, in precisely that the Roman state wants to take care of its economic realm. It treats itself as though it has to manage the expenses and manage the household and manage production and all this sort of thing. And it starts to take that first step away from the autonomous or the sort of individualized household that produces free citizens. And instead, now we have a state that does that. And one of the things that's critical is that when you pull the duties of the household out of the private sphere into the public sphere, you pull violence with it. So the purpose of the political realm ceases to be completely governed by speech and persuasion, and now you introduce the element of violence into the political realm. And that's, I think, where it all starts to go downhill.
Hmm? Where are you?
Which is
the violence part?
Yeah, I don't remember that claim either.
All right.
Bringing a violence into the... So I think we're in section 5.
Okay.
Yeah, I thought the big danger of the social realm was with everybody poo-pooing each other into conformity, not the entrance of violence in the way that the man would beat his slaves now is in the political realm, and so I can go to the market and beat the grocer. I didn't think that would be the deal.
It's certainly violence in the sense of a totalitarian society is certainly one possibility, but there's also... There's a whole long list of things that are wrong with this.
With the social. She will eventually say that when we get to the Middle Ages and you have the emerging of a merchant class that wants to protect its private property so that it can create more wealth, it turns to the state to enforce contracts through force and violence. Violence becomes part of the state when it's understood as governing the social realm.
Well, and then
feudal lords are still restricted. She's trying to draw a contrast between a head of the household and a feudal lord. And the feudal lord is still bound by the law. Okay. Let's look to where it is. I think it's chapter 6.
Page 30. The realm of the polis, on the contrary, was the sphere of freedom. Mm-hmm. And if there was a relationship between these two spheres, it was a matter, of course, that the mastering of the necessities of life in the household was the condition for freedom under the polis. Under no circumstances could politics be only a means to protect society, whether that's a society of the faithful, as in the Middle Ages, or a society of property owners, as in Locke, or a society relentlessly engaged in a process of acquisition, as in Hobbes, or a society of producers, as in Marx, or a society of job holders, as in our own society, or a society of laborers, as in a socialist and communist countries. In all these cases, it is the freedom, and in some instances, so-called freedom of society, which requires and justifies the restraint of political authority. Freedom is located in the realm of the social, and force or violence becomes the monopoly of the government.
Cha-ching.
That's all I meant.
I've got a note about page 33, a little after that. The rising of economic activities to the public realm means that political action, political speech, become the superstructure over social interests. So she says this is an insight that usually is attributed to Marx, that really the political parties, say, arguing, it's just classes. But that's right in there. That's not a matter of that moment of development of classes in particular. That's just right there as soon as you have the social become something that is primarily there to protect the economic, which happens as soon as you get a mass society, seemingly. This kind of egalitarianism that she was shooting for seems like, at least, that it only works in small little, like the polis, small little units. So once you get a mass society, is it just inherent? Like, it seems to me that the part of what was objectionable about the social is not just that everything becomes economic, but just think of it in terms of sort of small town conformism and morality being enforced in a way that if there was truly respect for individuals, or it was individuals meeting in a polis and nobody's got the monopoly on moral correctness, you could have a plurality, that's kind of plurality she wants, that the leveling doesn't necessarily require a mass. You could have a pretty small group, but the point is it's kind of like a family. Like a family, you know, at least traditionally, they kind of had one view. Maybe the woman or the kids didn't have any views at all, but if they had a view, they would just kind of parrot what the head of the household says. The only difference with a slightly larger group is that you actually stop needing a tyrant or someone. I mean, you could have Mussolini, like she describes tyrannies as the worst kind of this. You have Mussolini or somebody like that parroting a thing, and then everybody, you know, is just locked in step with that. They have the same view. There's not a multiplicity of voices interacting in any meaningful political way, even if they all get to vote for their one candidate or something.
Yeah, well, that's doing violence to one of human conditions, that plurality, one of the most important defining conditions of us.
She calls it a condition of action. The reason why plurality is a condition of action, I mean, she's thinking about the sense in which action is the true expression of individuality. It's actually spontaneous, yes. And it requires individuals. It requires that human beings not just be conformist slaves to the social whose behaviors are predictably routine because of this, you know, tyranny of the masses.
So. Right. So it doesn't have to be a tyrant anymore, that after, even right. In a small group, it could not be an actual leader, but it's a leader of no one. That bureaucracy becomes the leader.
Yeah.
So we could even have an ostensibly democratic, egalitarian system in which still the bad thing about society and the homogeneity that
So this is chapter rampant. This is chapter six or section six we're talking about. And the primary problem with the social is just it deprives us of this public realm, which is what we need to be fully human, this realm of action. And then she goes into this thing about the emergence of the intimate. Rousseau is the first theorist of the intimate as a sort of rebellion, romantic rebellion against the social and the conformism that comes along with the social. And then she gets into this idea that conformity basically excludes the possibility of action. And the equality that's predicated on that is not this equality of peers that you get in the polis. It's not actually equality of these free individuals.
So the intimate was in advance in the private realm. You didn't have the intimate in the ancient Greek tyranny of the family. But it's not just that, you know, you've got this Greek condition and then the intimate comes out in that. It's that the social came out in reaction and sort of crushed the polis model. And then in reaction, you know, we got more dialectic going on. In reaction to that, you get the intimate.
Yeah, it's like the shrunken residue of the private realm. It's what we're left with.
Well, I don't know, because remember what I was just saying is the private realm starts as this place of violence. The intimate, you actually have an authentic encounter. It may be just with another person, with your spouse, with your kid, but the intimate is...
Let's give an example. What do we mean by the intimate?
Let me tell you what she says. But so on the theme of that the development of society brings the private out into the open, right? So we don't want to talk about public space in the way that she defined it originally. As you develop society and the household gets drawn into the open, we'll just say things that were private before no longer private, right? The private household is no longer private. So we lose privacy.
Like the production of stuff. I mean, we don't think of that as private, but that was something that was hidden away in the household in Greece.
Yeah. And so you have this sort of development over time of this erosion of the private to the point where we get to Rousseau. And she says,
what page?
38, bottom. The first articulate explorer and to an extent even theorist of intimacy was Jean-Jacques Rousseau. He arrived at his discovery through a rebellion not against the oppression of the state, but against society's unbearable perversion of the human heart, its intrusion upon an innermost region in man which until then had needed no special protection. The intimacy of the heart, unlike the private household, has no objective tangible place in the world, nor can society, against which it protests and asserts itself, be localized with the same certainty as the public space.
So the intimate is your thoughts and feelings.
Yeah.
Yes. So, the original dividing line between public and private is
the four walls of my compound.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. It's the actual house. And then that gets collapsed together, and then you get a new dividing line, and you've retreated.
Yeah.
Whatever
so
you want to call
what's
it.
Truly, psyche. What's truly private is only what you hold inside.
The psyche as opposed to the household.
Yeah. Right.
So that's the sense in which the private realm shrinks.
Yeah, but I mean, so here would be the idea of marrying for love versus marrying for economic stability.
It's just there's two realms of the intimate we're talking about. One, you were talking a little more about the purely solitary, the vita contemplative.
Contemplative life.
Yeah, the contemplative life, where you're really just by yourself, or even there's even some sort of variations of that. You could be, my thoughts are keeping me company if I'm a philosopher, but yet if I'm a truly religious person, then that's really wordless. That's standing before the eternal, and that's very lonely. You know, if you didn't have the God model there to fill that out, you would go absolutely insane if you had that. So you got that, and those are forms of the intimate. You know, it's the inner, it's the private is shrunk to what's in my head. But the intimate, obviously, as we were talking about, is, you know, the romance novel is love, is an encounter with another. You know, we got this model going back to Hegel and with Buber and folks like that, where to be a full self.
It could be an encounter with the other, but it's...
To be a full self, you only really need one other person. You at least need that. If you were just by yourself, alone on an island, you know... You're basically the same as an animal. You don't get a sense of self. You need somebody else looking at you to get an idea. And she says one of the things about political action here is that it's always somehow showing yourself. But Arendt, unlike these other folks, seems to think that that can't happen with just two people. That the intimate still is a little too much like that family unit before where everybody kind of has the same opinion, right? If you're a couple, yeah, you provide some objectivity to each other. You call each other on each other's bullshit. But you still kind of become a unit, or else it doesn't really work. And so it still doesn't provide the requisite fullness, objectivity to give you a public world for you to be fully human.
No.
You can't be free.
Yes.
That's the way she would
absolutely
say.
Right. But I think all she's saying is that this is just a response to the shrinking of the private. It's an attempt to try to reclaim the private, but it's not really the private anymore. It's intimacy. That's all. I thought that was the main point of that whole bit, right?
It seems weird to say.
Well, they're trying to get at why intimacy isn't good enough. Why is that not?
Yeah, because there's. I mean,
I'm telling you because it's not what it's not the public. I mean,
see, here's one way that becomes a little bit confusing is intimacy would require speech.
One would hope.
Not all intimacy.
So, intimacy requires affirmative consent.
We're classy. That's all I can say. So she characterizes the public and the political as being decisively about speech. And so this is the act of our plurality. She says early on, plurality is the condition of human action because we are all the same, that is human, in such a way that nobody is ever the same as anyone else who ever lived, lives, or will live. And so speech is such a sign of our plurality is, on the one hand, our speech presumes that kind of sameness, that I'm speaking to another person. But it's an act of us utterly individually.
Or else you wouldn't have to say anything.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. And so what's confusing about this analysis of having our freedom only in the political is why other acts of speech that are maybe intimate or private in the way we've been talking about, in the way she would analyze it, why those aren't free? Why those aren't a sign of our freedom? What is it about? Is it just the issue of violence and authority within those relationships, or
are they free from necessity? Are they outside of the realm of things we need? And we need that kind of freedom for it to rise to the level of the speech, action, diet.
The fact that you need a spouse or something.
So to be free from necessity means makes it. Well, I'm sorry to say that again.
The fact that you need a spouse would make it part of necessity or something. You know, or you need someone to love in a different way than you need people in a community to have.
So our human relationships are predicated on this, fulfilling a
So
fulfilling the social need. But in the polis, it's not a matter those to be free. Those interactions can't be predicated on, oh, I'm fulfilling my social need now. They're free of that necessity. It's the idea of this human interaction that rises above that, rises above lust, pleasure of interaction, all of those things.
There would be other kinds of intimate relationships, friendships, for instance, that would also, she would not admit them of being political in this way and freeing in the same way, I don't think.
So I didn't quite read it that same way. I think the way I would characterize it in her language is to say that intimacy is the recognition of the behavioral pressures that society places on us, and that the rebellion is to act in a way that we're being told not to, or that not act in the way that we are being told. So insofar as society generates this, she actually, the term she uses is she says, a complete victory of society is characterized by a communistic fiction that is ruled by no one. This is what Mark was talking about earlier. And she actually references in this context Adam Smith's Invisible Hand. So it's a nice little twist talking about the invisible hand of the market emerging out of the actions of individual
actors.
What
does it say what the communistic fiction is?
It could be anything. It's the idea that society has one interest and one goal.
We have a common good.
It's the idea that
we have the commonwealth
interest.
Has a common goal, right?
Which, strangely enough, comes partially out of Rousseau, too, right? The idea of a common good in this place.
Yeah. Well, no, but the point is, when you believe that there's a common goal for society, then behaviors will be dictated. Your job is to marry this person at this social status. Your job is to be a laborer. You're a slave. You're a serf. You're a noble, right? And so what Rousseau and the Romantics are rebelling, the way I read it was saying, recognizing that the stricture is in place and rebelling against that prescribed behavior, but that's still not free action in the sense of, because you're not among in this community of equals sort of spontaneously generating this free action. You're basically just responding to what's been thrown at you in your trying to overcome it in some way or rebel against it. That's the way I interpreted it.
So in 40, she says, the phenomenon of conformism is characteristic of the last stage of this modern development. It's related to communistic tendency. It is true that one-man monarchical rule, which the ancients stated to be the organizational device of the household, is transformed in society. As we know it today, when the peak of the social order is no longer formed by the royal household of an absolute ruler into a kind of no-man rule. But this nobody, the assumed one interest of society as a whole in economics, as well as the assumed one opinion of polite society in the salon, does not cease to rule for having lost its personality. As we know from the most social form of government, that is from bureaucracy, the rule by nobody is not necessarily no rule. It may indeed, under certain circumstances, even turn out to be one of the cruelest and most tyrannical versions. But I also thought of Rousseau in this section, in my liner notes, because of the social contract and the common good and the general will.
And general will.
Right.
So let's try to understand. She thinks she's condemning both capitalism and Marxism equally, that they both have the wrong starting point. They have the wrong conceptual framework.
The same wrong starting point.
Yes, which is this society, which involves them being a common good. And she talks about companies. This sounds weird. Like, the whole point of capitalism and competition among capitalism is that it's not like a family. That in a family, the individual siblings hopefully are not competing in that way and producing alternate. I made dinner. Well, I made dinner too. I prefer your dinner. Go throw that away. Hopefully they're not doing that. But yet he wants to say that, you know, you used to have just all your slaves and they would do the farming for you and you don't need to trade with anybody outside. Getting these independent entities, companies, I mean, first of all, entering into a company itself. He says company comes from people who share bread or something like that.
Is he talking about her?
Yes, Arendt.
I don't remember that. This isn't an extra section.
No. Okay. It's
in a footnote somewhere, I'm sure.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Ein Aristotelian Kai Hyperikon.
Page 35. Companies is men who eat one bread. The company actually became, you know, you only get the social when you get the breakdown in some ways of those traditional extended family units with the slaves and all that. And instead you get companies, you get guilds, you get all these things in the Middle Ages that really did have a family-like structure. The thing I'm having trouble understanding is then when you extend out from that to actual competition, it seems like the only common good there is we want to raise GDP or something. So is that enough to get?
No, I think she answers that towards the end. She talks about private property, and maybe we should hold off on that, maybe not jump into that right now. But we can.
Well, one of the founding things of this book, it was supposed to be, you know, she'd just written Eichmann in Jerusalem. This was supposed to be about Marx, like when she kind of entered into this.
Right.
And it kind of became its own thing, and it's only tangentially about Marx, but it ends up being a deep critique of why you might think that, oh, the problem with the social taking over is just capitalism taking over, and the conformity and the mass, you know, a lot of the things we've said about what that means sounds like an attack
usually,
on capitalism.
Yeah.
But she's saying, no, to reject that, and elsewhere, she says this about some other kinds of supposed revolutions. Even if you take a conceptual scheme and turn it upside down, like, now we're going to transvalue the values, like, you're still keeping the conceptual scheme itself intact. Yeah. You're not actually undoing the mistake. And so that's her, as clearly as I can get at this point, of her critique of Marx, which is not very clear.
Okay.
Your critique of Marx mainly happens in the labor chapter.
Okay.
Yeah. But it does amount to what you said of saying that Marx, in trying to turn things upside down, is really doing exactly the same thing as Smith. In fact, she lumps Smith, Marx, Locke, all of them all in one place.
She's
having
great.
Basically the same,
yeah.
the same, you know, theoretical underpinning for the relationship of human beings to their labor and the relationship of us to our work.
Yes. Yeah, so
and they all make the same mistake. They come to different ends, but they all make the same mistake.
Say a little more what that mistake is.
They don't understand the relationship of what our freedom really is. In all their cases, they're thinking of freedom in terms of elevating labor as being our most central activity. And so that in all cases, we become only laborers, whether it be Marx or whether it be Smith. And that is not a proper understanding of our human condition, because in all those cases, we're slaves. We're slaves to our labor. And in order to be free, we have to be freely acting individuals.
Yeah.
All right, that's the end of part one. Check back next week for part two, or go to partiallyexaminedlife.com, become a Partially Examined Life citizen, and get the whole thing right now. That'll also enable you to participate in the not-school stuff that Nathan's about to tell you about right now.
Hey everyone, Nathan Hanks here with an update from the Partially Examined Life's Not School. There's lots of ways for members to get involved with others in the Citizens Forum. This October, groups are looking to start reading The Irony of American History by Reinhold Niebuhr, Critique of Pure Reason by Immanuel Kant, and Chapter 3 by Zizek in Contingency, Hegemony, and Universality. If you're not into any of these, you can propose your own and start another topic for discussion. That's all in the Citizens Forum. If you have any questions about Not School, contact me. That's Nathan at PartiallyExaminedLife.com. Thanks for listening.